Okay, I think it's on now. Let's see, today's date is Thursday, November 13, 2014. My name is Jonathan Gerland. I'm in the home of Mr. Clayton Jurcik here in Lufkin. And today we're going to do a recorded interview about his time and experiences at Lufkin Industries. So Mr. Jurcik, if you would, maybe begin by telling us when and where you were born.
I was born in Cleveland, Texas, in 1924, April the 22nd, 1924. I was one of seven children. I'm going to make this brief because it's just as long as...
Go ahead.
Anyway, my dad came over from Czechoslovakia when he was 18 years old, landed in Galveston, and he came over as a banker, and he worked throughout the state, and finally he came to Cleveland, Texas, in the nineteen teens somewhere.
When did he come into Galveston? When did he get to Galveston?
You said 1912, I think.
12, okay.
1912.
So right before the war then. World War One. Okay.
Right.
From Czechoslovakia.
Yep, right.
Okay.
And he tells a story that he walked from his hometown in Czechoslovakia to Brenham, where he caught the ship to come over here with all, you know, there were a lot of immigrants coming over then, so.
Is that B-R-E-M-E-N, Bremen?
Bremen, Germany.
Okay.
That was the port that they
left. How would you spell that?
Well, I think it's B-R-E-N-M-E-N, Bremen. You'll have to look that
okay,
up.
Okay, okay. All right.
So anyway, he opened that bakery there, and back then, in a small town, I don't know where you're from, but in a small town back then, the little town would have a grocery store, a meat market, and maybe a hardware store, and a bakery, because the bakery furnished the bread for the area there, see. Because if you didn't have bread, you break biscuits or bake your own bread. So anyway, that's how that got started. So anyway, I was raised there, and graduated from Cleveland High School in 1942.
Did you help your father at the bakery?
Oh, yeah. With
all the kids?
All seven of us did.
All seven of you.
That's right.
What kind of work would you do?
My dad was an investor. In other words, he built up the business. And during the Depression of 1932, he lost $2,000 with a brokerage firm in Houston that went bankrupt. And you would think that with all these kids, of course I don't know how many kids we had then, but anyway, but he made it through. So, but anyway, so we've all been investors since then. In other words, I live off my investments. I sure don't live off my income tax, my retirement, because they're retirement numbers. So anyway, graduated from high school.
Did your father and mother, did they encourage all your siblings to go to college?
Yes. And we all did, except my oldest brother. My oldest brother stayed there, and he took over the bakery from my dad. In other words, he inherited that. And everybody had a college education except the oldest sister. And well, she had to change to go to college, and she went. She went over to Sam Houston. But she was away from home, and so she wanted to have a good time, so she fooled around. And I guess didn't make good grade anyway. He pulled her out and sent her to a business college, and she held that against him for the rest of her life. But let's get back to it. Anyway, so I graduated at 1942.
Cleveland. Yes, sir.
And that was just at the start of the war. And me and three of my buddies, there were three of us, enrolled at A&M, Texas A&M. And I spent, I think, two semesters there, or maybe a semester I had, and got a draft notice. Well, since I got my draft notice, I dropped out of school and went back to Cleveland and waited for the draft. And then all of a sudden, that draft call was canceled. So I stayed there and helped my dad in the bakery. And then I got another draft notice. And turned out I had a heart condition that I don't know, born with it or what. It was enlarged heart at one time. Anyway, that knocked me out of the draft. I didn't have to serve. So, I don't know how much time I spent after that, but I went back to A&M in 19, sometime in the 40s.
After the war?
No, it was
still the war.
I don't remember.
Okay.
Because I don't remember exactly what it was. Remember, I'm 90 years old. So this list here, though, when I couldn't call one fellow last night, or not yesterday afternoon, and I called a fellow that's still working at Lufkin Industries and asked him, who was the so-and-so? And he said, well, I'll let you know in a minute. Well, after I hung up, I thought about this fellow. And then from there on, I started thinking about all these other things. It's amazing. See, I've been gone for 50 years, and all these names came back to me.
Yes, sir.
But anyway.
And we'll get to the list in just a minute. What did you major in?
Mechanical engineering.
Mechanical engineering.
Yes.
Okay. How did you come to work for Lufkin Industries?
After I got out of school, I jobbed a hard back then, but I went to work for a company that, they were a construction company. I think it's C.F. Braun the first time. I've destroyed those records too. But anyway, and it was at Pasadena. We built a plant for making tetraethyl lead. And I think I spent, seemed like it was 2 years there. Now I can't. Anyway, after we got that plant built, well, I was laid off. But then they had another contract to build an alumina plant at Corpus Christi. So I followed over there and spent, seemed like 2 years, maybe it wasn't, building that plant in Corpus Christi. And, all this time was as an engineer. In other words, work measurement. In other words, how much kept track of the progress of the construction. And after that, I don't know how I went to work for Pan American Pipeline. Because those construction jobs, after they finish the job, you get laid off, see. So I went to work for Pan American Pipeline and worked. I was based in Snyder as an engineer out there. And what I was doing was laying out pipelines. In other words, usually from gathering system, but also I laid out one major pipeline from one town to the next town too. And had a big era there. Let's see. No, that's another era there.
Okay.
So anyway, and while I was working there, there was a fella who was selling scrap to Lufkin Industries that knew Ed Trout. They supposed were big buddies. And this fella was my brother's brother-in-law. He wasn't kidding me, you know, brother-in-law. So anyway, he told, and I don't know how in the world how the conversation got to me with Ed Trout. So anyway, this fella called me and said Ed Trout wanted to see me. So I went to see Ed Trout and he hired me. And of course this was in 55, I guess, because I went to work in 55. So that's when I came to Lufkin, was in 1955. And I started out in the foundry, where I wanted to be. Well, to back up a little bit, my foundry experience was at A&M. They had a course back then that was called manufacturing methods or something, but anyway, including in it was making castings. In other words, you made the molds, and we had a small cupola, and we melted the metal and poured the castings. And then after you did that, you machined the casting, so you carried it all the way through. Now they don't offer that course anymore, and I'm surprised. Well, because things have got too too complicated, or it's all computers now. In other words, it has to do with computers, so the computer science and all that. So they don't offer basic courses like that anymore. You just pick them up in industry. Mm-hmm. Well, places like out at Angelina College, they don't offer things like that, but they offer basic courses, you know, like machining and things like that.
What was the foundry doing when you first started working for Lufkin Industries? What do you remember was going on at the time you were hired?
I'm still making pumping units. It was all pumping units back then.
Making the castings for all
of them? Well, you know, the foundry department, when you speak of the foundry, we made the castings, and then the castings went over to the machine shop to be machined, and then there were some fabrications in the fabrication shop. It all came together on a truck and went out to the field.
I want to ask you some details about foundry work in general, but before we get to that, you were an engineer. They hired you to be an engineer?
Yes, yes.
To work in the foundry. So what specifically was an engineer to do at the foundry?
He designed machinery and studied the methods of which they were being used to do work more efficiently. In other words, the first projects I had, when I went to work there, I was working under Arnold Tompkins.
Arnold Tompkins?
Yeah, you've heard of him.
I've seen the name, but I don't know.
Arnold Tompkins was lucky for quite a few years, and then he went to work for Love Wood Products as a pilot.
Okay.
And I guess he was there till he retired. He died many, many years ago, like so many folks do. In other words, everybody I knew has died. That's the problem.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
So would you research, the types of metals, the composition of the castings itself?
That's another field by itself. That's a metallurgy.
Metallurgy, okay.
That has to do with metallurgy.
You were more in the end product. What was needed in the field?
You know, what was needed in the plant to make the plant more efficient.
Okay.
In other words, you know how we melt metal in a foundry?
Well, what kind of furnace did you use?
It was a cupola.
Cupola furnace, okay.
You know what a cupola is?
Well, describe it for the recording for us.
In our case, was a big cylinder about 10 feet in diameter and about 50 feet tall, I guess. And, by the way, you can still see one sticking out at the foundry here. And no, I didn't design that one. But anyway, it's a tube that's about 10, 12 feet in diameter. It's lined with refractory. And on the bottom of it, it has two doors. And there's a door about halfway up that's not a door, but an opening. And that's where you charge the material in.
Now, when you say it was lined with refractory, what exactly is that?
It was lined with a refractory that was blown in like shotcrete.
Was it like asbestos or?
No, it's refractory clay.
Refractory clay.
Yeah.
Okay, clay.
It's got a name, I can't remember what it was. And I want to make a point here that has to be done every day. In other words, you start melting about 9 o'clock because you got everything ready. And then about 4 o'clock, you drop everything out, and you have to reline. Well, during the Korean War, we had the man that did that had been doing it for years and years and years. That went down in this thing with this gun. He's in this tube,
and
he's got all kinds of protection, uh-huh. But he has to turn around and blow this thing like this and build that lining back up. This fella lost his son in the Korean War. And he came to work anyhow. He was that dependable. His name was John Elijah.
John Elijah?
Yeah, he's a black fella. And he's the most dedicated fella that I think that we had there to do that.
He did that every day?
He did that 5 days a week, six, yeah. He was off on weekends.
That's the reline?
Yeah, reline. Well, the process itself, we described the cupola, but in the cupola, it has clay bottom. Well, it's not clay, it's molding sand. Because you build it up so high in there, Then you chart in some wood. I think we started with wood. I don't remember now. There's two parts. But anyway, and a bed of coke. You know what coke is?
Coke?
Coke. You know what it is? Coke is coal that has all the volatiles burn out. They take coal and heat it, and all these volatiles come off, and it leaves pure carbon in.
Okay.
All right. You build that bed up so high, which is this immaterial right now, and then in the morning you come in and build a fire in there with gas burners. That's what it was.
Gas burners?
You stick gas burner to heat that stuff and get it burning, because pure carbon will burn, of course. So after you know this, on fire and lit, well, then you start charging in material. And you charge in your cast iron and limestone and any alloys that you want to mix with this.
The metallurgists all determine that.
Yeah, the metallurgists determine
that. The ingredients
that's right.
of what was going to be melted.
So then you start blowing air in there. You've got a big blower that blows it air in there that about 2 or 3 pounds pressure. I don't remember what it is.
Is that what makes it a blast furnace?
It's like a blast furnace on the way called a cupola, because a blast furnace is used in the steel industry.
Okay.
And they're huge. They're a lot bigger than this.
Okay.
All right. You blow that air in there, and the iron starts melting, but it trickles down through the bed that you had. You also keep adding coke, so you maintain your bed. You burn up some, and you add some more at the same time. You're charging out the iron, the flux, and the coke. In different charges. You just keep charging there and it melts down. Then it's a little different now, but back then you had a hole in that side of the cupola. It was lined, of course, where as the iron melted, it built up in the bottom and pushed the coke up, and the flux was on top. In other words, this iron limestone is the flux that you use. It would melt too, and it would cleanse the iron as it melted. And it would float on top. Well, after it floated up so high, there was a hole out the back that the limestone, the melted limestone, what we call slag, was coming
slag,
out.
Slag, yeah.
The slag was coming out, and we were putting it in a big pan of water. It had several hundred gallons of water. And we had a man back there, and I can't remember his name because he was another one. He was one of the oldest employees we had. And all his job was to watch that stuff coming out, watch the slag coming out. And as soon as he saw some iron, he could tell the difference. Even though they were both molten, he could tell the difference. And he would ring a bell, and they'd punch a hole in the bottom of that, a spout at the bottom, to drain the iron out. And after the iron would drain out, well, they had a clay plug. You'd plug back in there and melt some more iron to build up. And he's still watching it back there all the time. But sometimes if they didn't knock the hole out of to drain that iron out quick enough, the iron would start coming out the back. And when he would come out the back and hit that water, it would explode. And I mean, it would wake you up. In other words, it was a heck of an explosion, because that was molten iron hitting coal, hitting water. And because, see, when the slag hit it, the slag just didn't have that much heat content as the iron did. So it would just go in there and the water would boil some, but that would be it. But you had a blast when that iron hit that water. So that's the old way we did it.
So that's the way you were doing it when you started.
When I started, that's right.
Yeah. And so when did it change?
We wore that cupola out. That cupola, I think, was the original. The foundry, to back up a little bit, the foundry was built in 1946. W.C. Trout had, well, he had a lot of good designers there, and they designed it, the building and all. Well, I'm not positive about that. That building had to be fabricated somewhere else. There were a lot of the other buildings that they did. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the building was built 46, so that must have been when the cupola was built. Well, you finally, that heat gets it wore out, so I had to put in another cupola. And based on what was in the past, I designed it the same way. In other words, using the same, there were some modifications. And don't ask me because I can't remember that far back. But one thing we did do, the metallurgists had discovered a process where the iron and the slag came out. Let me think a minute. How that? Because that's what they use now. The iron and the slag come out of the same, what we call the tap hole at the top. They come out together somehow, and the slag floats on top and goes right off of here. And the slag, I mean the iron, it goes, well actually the iron is on the bottom and the slag is coming off the top like this. Mm-hmm. They're coming out together. And the slag, we were still using the pan to catch the slag, but we weren't having that explosion. In other words, because mm-hmm. they were separated out there in front. We wouldn't work depending on somebody in the back to do that. So that process was an innovation. And then later, what they're using now is that the slag lands on a cast iron plate that's traveling. And you don't use any water because you had to cut down on the water because of pollution. See, we were, we were big polluters back then.
So the water just went into the creeks?
Well, we recirculated some of it, but there was always so much wastewater. The most pollution we did was out of the cupola, because coming out of the cupola, you've got all these cinders and CO2 and CO. You generate a lot of CO.
Carbon dioxide?
Yes, because you have to be careful working on the second floor up there or anywhere on top that you didn't overcome, because we had one fella overcome with it, but he got it out all right because the exhaust gas from cupola are real rich. Well, as it came out on the old cupola, we had here's the stack and here's the cone up here, and you had a spray of water coming on that cone and it come down like that and had a trough around it, and the gases passed through that and it would collect a lot of this stuff, but it didn't collect it all. So you always had stuff coming out the top of the cupola. Well, here comes EPA, and so you can't do that anymore.
And that would have been in the 70s, right? The EPA, the Environmental Protection
Agency?
Yeah, I
guess so. I think we started before then, of course.
72 or 73, I think.
I don't know how many. Let's see. I went from that. We went from that to a closed top. And it came off, that these were designed by people that sold the equipment. We came off of the cupola and into a venturi, and we were spraying water in it like that under high pressure. And that was capturing a lot of the gases. But the only problem was you had to create a big suction to overcome the expansion that was coming out of the cupola. Mm-hmm. So you had to have a negative pressure on that thing, so you had a big fan. It was 500 horsepower and a huge fan. I think it was 5 feet in diameter, and it was sucking on this venturi with this water, and then the water was separated somewhere. This was because this water was in this impeller, and then that went out of stack, and it was fairly clean. But the only problem was the maintenance on this fan. Every weekend, or not every weekend, practically every, I had to go in there with the maintenance people and balance that fan, because this water was loaded with the stuff from the limestone, calcium.
And it would calcium?
Build up on the blade.
Okay, calcium.
And get out of balance. And if you got that fan out of balance at that speed, it was I think 3,600 RPM. A huge fan.
Wow.
And you can't tolerate that thing getting out of balance because it'll tear itself loose and stay off. And my office was right across from it. So anyway, every so often, I'd get maintenance to open that thing up, and they would clean it. They'd clean it the best they could. They would sandblast those blades. And I would go in there and take some little pieces of metal, and we would disconnect the coupling to the motor and put oil in the bearing so it would turn real free. And I would sit there and put the little plates on there and make sure that it, in other words, if I opened it up and it turned to the bottom like that, it was too heavy down here. So I'd bring it up here and bring it around and put a little weight over here and see what happened.
So you had to rebalance it every time.
Yeah, we're rebalancing the thing. Of course, it's all done. They do it all the time over the shop now, but we didn't have that kind
of... So you just manually added weights to the blade.
Yeah. After you found out what it was, then you'd tack them on there, see? You'd tack them on there so they'd stay there. And okay. So...
Well, let's talk a little bit about... You've given us a lot of good details about that, but a question that keeps coming to my mind is, and you've alluded to it, is just the working conditions. Talk a little bit more specifically about... You know, you mentioned the fan and Mr. Elijah having to clean out the furnace and everything. So talk a little bit about the working conditions when you first started and, you know, maybe how it changed over the years to when you left.
Okay, we had...
What were some of the other jobs and things that people had to do around the foundry?
Well, you had the melting department, you had the molding department.
Molding department?
Yeah, molding department. You had the core department. And you had the cleaning department.
Okay.
All right. Do you have any idea how they make a mold?
A mold?
Yeah, the mold.
Was it somehow with sand or something?
Yes,
or?
It's out of sand. Well, that's... you know a little bit. You had a big box here. And you had a pattern that you... here's this box.
That's all right, yeah. I moved the recorder. Go ahead.
You'd put this box around this back. And then we used to use carbon bonded sand. It was just ordinarily silica sand that had seco and clay was the binder actually, and it was mixed over here in a big machine that would mull it up, and you could send out the machine here to where this box was, and you'd put this stuff in there, and this is the big mold now. And you had a big table that about twice as big as this where this box was sitting on, and it'd go up and down. In other words, I could go like that. That's a jolt machine.
Jolt?
That's a jolt machine. That would pack this box. That's the only half of the mold. And then you had to get on top with a rammer and ram the rest of it because it only jolted right down to the bottom because it was depending on the weight. So you had these fellas get on top with a pneumatic packer and pack the sand and rake it off. And then you had a 10-ton crane that would pull this box off, and of course the pattern would stay there. And you had to put this in the oven and dry it. And they were dried, I think, for 12 hours. We had, I think, four of these big ovens. And you'd take this box, this was half a mold now, and you'd put it on the car, and when you got the car loaded, you'd load it in the oven. Well, see, that was only half the mold. Half the mold. So to make the other half, see, we've got all this made. When we turn it over, we've got to make this half right here. So it's the same process. But those two things would match. In other words, they had pins so that they would match. And you'd come out with a casting like this then when you get to, it'd be the completed casting.
So the mold was a combination of sand and clay and...
And yes, and sea coal and some other binders, which I don't know now. Yeah,
okay.
Refractory. Well, you had to bake those things. You bake them for 12 hours because you can't tolerate the moisture again.
Okay.
In other words, if you had moisture, that thing would blow up. Well,
did that ever happen? Did you ever have any molds that blew up?
No, because they were all dry. You made sure they were dry. I'm sure we had some runouts. See, after you made these two molds, you had what we call a cope and a drag. A drag was the bottom. You take the cope and put it on top, and that completed your cavity there. Then
you saying like COPE?
Cope. COPE.
Okay. Cope and the drag. Yeah. Okay.
And then, to further complicate things, if it was a gearbox and it was all hollow, so your mold would only make this part, but then it's hollow, so you had a core that would go in there that would be supported such that the iron could go all the way around this core. You don't know anything about a founder, do you? Okay. That's all right. So this core was in there to form the hollow parts, and such as a gearbox. And it was made in a similar process. Back then it was made the same process using this clay bonded sand. But see, this clay bonded sand, to make the clay activated, you had to put water in there, of course. And so you had to control that very close and how much water you put in. So when you made a course, you had to also bake the cores. And we had an oven for that. Well, I might as well get off on this. This is not a tangent, but back in sometime in the 70s, I think. Well, I don't remember. You can't pin me down on dates, but we had a fella, Bill Trout. You know Bill Trout?
Bill Trout, yes, sir.
He came over with a fella from the University of Texas. And since I'm an Aggie, I'll never forget this guy. he was a professor, and he had Bill Trout all excited, says, "We're going to run out of natural gas."
Run out of natural gas.
In 1970s. And all of these big ovens we had were fired by natural gas. Well, management got excited, says, "Well, we got to have fuel." So they told me to go out and buy a big propane tank. And I don't think it was several thousand gallons that we had to put a tank in. And we had a mixer. So you can mix propane with air and get the same BTU output that you get from natural gas. The BTU of the just plain propane is real powerful. In other words, it would be too high. So you had to mix it with air to become. So we put this system in and set it out the yard waiting for the gas to get scarce.
Waiting for the...
And it never did get scarce. So we kept operating. But in the meantime, there's a new process that comes out. It's called chemically bonded sand. And actually, we were using, when I first came there, we were using a process that was bonded like that, except that it was using sodium silicate. And you could take sodium silicate, which is kind of a syrupy stuff, mix it with sand, and when you pass CO2 gas through it, it will harden. And I mean, it'll get hard. I mean, it's just like a brick. Well, this process was brought over here from the U.S. Right after the war. There was a German. His name was Carver. I can't remember his first name, but his name was Carver. And he flew over to Germany in his own plane. They said he put extra gas tanks in there. He was a German, by the way, but he was born over here, I guess. I don't know, but anyway, he was a German. He would speak German. So he went over there right after the war and got a lot of these patents. And this was one that he got, in other words, and brought that process back to the States and established his company. And the company still operates. But the problem with that process, as I said, these things were hard as brick. And so we use them in certain places, but we had a heck of a time getting them out. Because, see, this was a core. We only used it for making cores, as I remember. And I think we finally learned how to put some stretchers in there. It would stretch it out so it wouldn't be quite as hard. But that process I'm not using anymore, that particular process. But in the meantime, there are a new sand molding process that are called chemically bonded. And don't ask me what the chemical is, because it's made over at Diboll in that plant over there, whatever that, who is that over there, Diboll?
A plant in Dimebaugh?
It makes chemicals over there.
Oh, well, it was Borden.
Okay, well.
But now it's Hexion, I think.
Well, anyway, they made a chemical that you could use. That's too far back. I don't remember what they were. But anyway, that you had a mixer that you could put these two mixtures in this mixer like this, and they were mixing. It would mix in there. You'd put them in the mold, and after a few minutes, it would get hard because of the chemical process. I guess it was like an epoxy, same thing. They weren't epoxy, but it's like that. So you put that in the mold, and it would harden, and that eliminated the drying. You didn't have to dry them because they were dry already. There was no moisture involved, put it that way, because you used dry sand.
Okay.
Now, all the time, you're using sand that you reclaimed, though. In other words, it doesn't get complicated. It's a long story. See, after you make a mold, and this was in both cases, whether it's in the old process or the new chemical bond it's in, you make the mold, pour the iron in there, get the casting. After a period of time, you can shake it out. So you pick these molds up with a crane, and you put them on a big table. It's what's called a shakeout table. And you shake it like this. It's an unbalanced table, what it is. And it shakes the sand out, and it falls through a grate on this table. This table has a grate on it. The sand falls through it, and the casting is there in the mold. So you pull the copper drag off, and then you can take the casting and put it over here in a pile and let it cool off.
Could the molds be reused, or you had to have one mold for one
you
part?
You used the boxes again, so we had a box around it. You reused those, of course. You got a big stack. They're all different sizes. But the sand, when it comes out, you do reuse that.
But the mold itself is only good for one casting.
That's right, because... Okay.
So if you needed 100 castings, you'd have to have 100 molds.
That's right. And
that goes for everything that you cast.
That's right.
Whether it be I-beam or gearbox or whatever.
That's right.
Huh?
You made one mold for that casting, and the only thing that you salvaged out of it was the sand and the boxes. And of course, you got to cast.
And you had to start over again, make another mold. Okay.
But you did reuse the sand.
Right.
And that's another process that when the sand came out, you had to process it through, there's several ways to process it.
What type of, and also trying to talk a little bit more about working conditions, as far as safety, what kind of clothes and protective gear did workers wear in the foundry?
Around the cupola, they did wear, if anybody was around the molten iron, they wore shields for protect and you get these flashes from iron. And of course, everybody wore safety glasses. Now they were much bit more fancy. And
now they wear more like a mask, a shield?
Sort of like a welder's mask, only it was clear.
Okay.
Back then, we only wore the glasses.
Glasses, that's it. So your face skin was exposed?
Yeah, it was exposed because...
Your face skin was exposed.
Yeah. Unless you had an explosion, you weren't going to be burned. We didn't have to have an explosion, because that... Where an explosion took care in the back, there was never anybody back there because we were aware that that could happen.
What about gloves?
If you could wear gloves, you did, but not everybody wore gloves because so many times, of course, around the hand and the iron, they did wear gloves, but, did we have asbestos? I guess we had asbestos gloves back then.
Asbestos gloves.
And then what you were concerned about was the smoke, and you'd pull that off through the fan at the top of the building, see it would ride out and go at the top. But
other than that, you didn't wear any kind of
You were exposed to some gases, you did wear a very simple mask. In other words, it was just like the ones that you can buy at Lowe's out there. In other words, of course, things are different now.
Right, okay.
But mainly because you're not exposed to that anymore.
How did OSHA affect the way y'all worked?
How did what?
OSHA? The OSHA?
Well, fortunately, When they got to strict, I was retired.
Oh, okay, okay.
See,
and you retired in 86? Yes. 1986, yes. Okay.
But what I was fighting was the was EPA, because I was responsible for all this stuff that's, well, I guess it's, I don't remember, OSHA, or I guess you're both of them, because the plant water, in other words, we were, there's a park over here,
yeah, right across the street from Lufkin Industries, yeah, the park.
Well, there used to be a creek that, well, is the creek.
Yeah, there still is there,
well,
yeah.
But well, it headed up in the foundry, though. In other words, it came across and was the end of what's called a scrapyard crane. It wasn't a scrapyard crane, not that far down. Anyway, a creek hit up, and it was kind of a little, more left a spring there that, well, over a period of time, we keep talking about this molding sand. Well, even today it wears out. In other words, it gets to the point where you have to discharge some of it. So we dumped it right on the plant site. We had plenty of plant, and part of that was back there where I'm talking about. And it filled all that, it filled that creek up. And now then, the creek kind of heads under the railroad tracks out there now. Except some of the drainage, the foundry drainage still will come through there, but as a rule, it's not as dirty as it used to be.
They all just dumped it on the ground.
Dumped it on the ground, that's right.
And it filled in the creek?
Huh?
And it filled up the creek there, or where the spring was?
Yeah, it finally compacted itself, in other words. We reclaimed the property, what we were doing. I don't remember what the elevation was, but it must be 5 or 6 feet of fill there that we reclaimed over the years. Over the whole property over there where we dumped that sand. And then, when Philip, he started dumping across the street. You know where Pershing Street is?
Yes, sir.
You know where this building is on the long building, Lufkin Industry on the right.
Okay.
Well, across the street, where that substation is, Lufkin owns that. They own the property. And so that was all low. So we hauled sand over there for years, filling all that in. So there's it's kind of humped up because of all the sand. And then after OSHA came in, well, we had to start hauling that stuff somewhere else, and I don't know where it goes now. Because, yeah, I see, when I go that way, I see a truck pull out of there with a load of sand. So, that took care of that.
So what kind of injuries, if somebody was going to get hurt in the foundry, what were the common injuries?
Hurt backs, I guess.
Backs?
Yeah. In other words, lifting, because you did a lot of lifting. See, we were talking about big castings now, all this time. Well, we had another foundry, not another foundry, well, another foundry, another building right adjacent to the big foundry, where the big castings were made. And they were making a small casting, something similar to this. When I was talking about the main bay, I was talking about...
He's referring to a TV remote, television remote control.
Yeah. Okay. But the other castings I was talking about were as big as that TV, in other words, huge, bigger than a bathtub.
Okay.
The largest thing they make now is about twice as big as two bathtubs, you know, huge castings. That's what we call large casting. And the small casting, we make the little things from the size of your recorder there to up to about, 6 or 8 pounds, because they're all, well, they're not even more than that, they're about 50 pounds. But anyway, they're smaller, they didn't fit into the category of the big foundry. So you had another foundry that used the same processes, only in a smaller scale. You still used the same sand. And you had, for the very smallest castings, such as the size of that pencil, you had a man would have these, handle these molds all by hand. In other words, he had a little machine that would jolt and pack the sand. And then instead of having him pack it with that, he had a squeezer that, after he put the box on there, the drag, and put the sand there and jolted it, then he would put the squeeze head on and squeeze it. Now see, we kind of bypass this, but all of these patterns are mounted on plates. In the big foundry, they're mounted on cast iron plates that the foundry cast. But after they cast them, they've got to be machined. So these pattern plates, as we call them, would be sent over to the machine shop, and they would service them off, thing, you know, like this table. And then you'd mount the pattern on there, and it stayed there. I think in every case it would stay on that particular pattern plate.
What about fires? Was there any fires?
Because your sand, your floor is all sand. Your foundry has, in other words, if you just
even around the furnace and everything that
you don't have anything to burn. You're aware of fire all the time, of course.
Right.
And the only fires you can have would be electrical fire if you were careless. In other words, overload a circuit or something. But that's not. We never had a major fire that I can think of.
Now, did y'all get the metal? Where did y'all get did y'all use ingots or pig iron or anything like that?
We used scrap iron.
Scrap iron.
That's what the scrap yard was for. the scrap would come in, and back then it came in mostly from the railroad, and mainly from Houston. And like this fellow that I was telling you, there were several of them in Houston. Usually they're Jewish, but what has to do with it, I don't know. But anyway, they're always big in scrap. And so...
So are there different qualities of scrap iron? I mean, are they sorted by...
No, not for cast iron. No,
okay.
You don't have to sort it. We'd take entire engine blocks. In other words, the cupola was big enough that you could put a whole engine block in there and melt it back down to iron. And it might have the aluminum in there or something like that, but that would burn off. In other words, it wouldn't be any problem because it would be...
So the temperature of the fire then would determine how pure...
That's right.
You got how pure it was. Okay.
And all that stuff down.
What was a typical temperature that the furnace would operate at? If you remember, if not, don't worry about it.
About 2,800, as I remember. Yeah.
Fahrenheit?
Yeah.
2,800 degrees Fahrenheit.
And I don't...
That was standard for all the different types of things that you made?
No, because we have overlooked...
What about aluminum? Did y'all ever cast aluminum?
That's what I wanted to get around to.
Okay.
When I first came there, the foundry office itself was in a fairly long building right adjacent to the big foundry, the main bay. But there was an alleyway there for scrap trucks to back through there. And in the front end of the building was Robert Lang, who was the superintendent when I came there. And then we had next door to Robert Lang was the fellow that did the scheduling. His name was, it'll come to me after a while. And then the other two offices were back there for Arnold Tompkins tonight, and that's when I first came there. Well, across the street from there was the pattern shop, and that's where they made all these patterns for the things like they're showing you. You had to have a pattern. And you had a bunch of skilled workers in there that made these things out of wood. In other words, they didn't exactly carve them. They would saw them. Well, they did some carving. But they would have to make these big patterns, big and small, out of wood and mount them. Well, also, you had to have cores, and when you had small cores, you made them. You made the core boxes out of aluminum. See, and a core box is the same thing as this mold was. In other words, we had this mold, but now we're going to make a core box. So we make this out of aluminum and leave this cavity in there, and we put two pieces together and then pack it full of the core sand, and you pull it out, and you had to bake that again in the oven. And I want to mention that the fellow that was running that aluminum foundry was Houston Davidson. Houston Davidson.
Davidson.
And he had a black fellow with him there, Carl Ross. And those two guys were really good at it. Carl Ross, yeah. R-O-S-S.
R-O-S-S. Okay.
Well, about this time, Al Cutlett and another fellow who I can't remember his name, well, this fellow came up and went to Al Cutlett and said...
Is that Cutlett?
Cutlett. C-U-D-L-I-P-P.
Okay, yeah.
This fellow came to Al Cutlett and said, Lucky needs to make a chainsaw. So they went to the engineering department under Bale Hopper back then. As I remember, Bale Hopper had an engineer design the parts out of aluminum. In other words, the main parts. Now, the engine, they bought that. It's a little two-cycle engine that was standard, and they bought that.
You know where they bought it from? Who the maker was?
No, but okay. It's a common maker.
Okay.
There's one, if you haven't seen one, there's one out at the...
Forestry Museum.
Yeah, there's one out there. Well, won't say they dumped it in my lap, but they said, here, you produce these aluminum castings. We had to make the gas tank, and I don't remember the other housing parts. Well, we made them, but it was a...
Was the frame all out of aluminum, too?
I guess it was. I really can't recall that machine machine, so... But we had to make some of the complicated parts, and we had a lot of problems.
What about the bar, the chain, the bar?
Oh, no,
the chain?
We bought that chain. They bought that because that's steel, see?
Yeah,
we bought
okay.
the chain.
Steel.
Okay. All the thing we made was the gas tank and the handle. I can remember that. So anyway, that process was done. It says, here, you can take this in the aluminum foundry. We built another foundry for that. Well, to produce these castings, these aluminum castings.
Just for the chainsaw?
Yes. Well, no, it was not built just for that.
Oh.
Because sometime in the same period there, I don't remember when it was, we had to, Luckett had been buying the bushings, the main bearings on where the crankshaft turns the cranks. Those are big bushings in there that can be from that big to a saw. And those are cast out of aluminum, not aluminum, rather, leaded bronze. And they had been buying them from a foundry over in Beaumont. And I can't remember the name of that foundry's name, but they were, again, good friends of the Trouts. And so I don't know why they must have had some sort of a falling out. Says, well, we're going to make
Bethlehem,
them.
Maybe? Or
who?
Bethlehem?
No. Okay. It was a bronze foundry.
Okay.
No. It was a small operation. Anyway, they were producing these things over there. So they said, we're going to produce them over here. We're going to produce them ourselves. So that's really, I think, why we built that foundry. Well, it was made out of leaded bronze. And leaded bronze is bronze that has lead in it, but the lead is not in alloy form. It's in flakes in there.
In flex?
Flakes.
Flakes?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what would happen if the gearbox ran out of oil, in other words, the bearings weren't lubricated, the lead would lubricate the bearings. In other words, I guess to keep from seizing, I guess. I don't know. So we started producing those things. Well, in the meantime, this Houston Davidson that was running that got sick. And it turned out he had lead poisoning. And what happened was that we were melting that stuff, and he was breathing when you melt this, we had a little, what's called a crucible furnace for melting this.
Crucible, yes. Crucible
furnace. That's a clay pot that you fire around the outside and exhaust it out of there.
Right.
And again, it's fired with gas. And, he developed lead poisoning. In fact, I think both, I don't remember, I know.
From breathing the fumes of the lead?
Yeah, the lead oxide.
The lead oxide.
Okay, well, we don't say we panicked, but we knew or somehow heard about a fella up in somewhere in Indiana that had this same problem, and he designed a process for minimizing. He didn't solve it; he minimized it.
What
he
did,
we built a. First of all, I designed all this. I built a hood around these furnaces, and had a sliding door here and a sliding door here. When this door went up, this one went down, and you'd charge the metal in. And then when you get it melted, you'd slide this door down and pull this one up and get the metal out. In the meantime, one of these doors opened all the time, and you had a huge exhaust fan up here that was pulling air out and blowing that stuff out in the atmosphere. All it did was contaminate the area around there, but so far as I know. And I always worried about that, but for what I know, it didn't hurt anybody else, because he was getting concentrated doses of it.
Did you have anybody else that got sick? Was there anybody else?
There may have been one other fellow, but he didn't get as sick as he did. But anyway, they cured him of it. They knew what it was, and they found out what it was, and he's cured. And he lived way on up there.
Well, was he an employee of Lufkin Industries?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was. Okay.
Yeah, he was.
Houston Davidson. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. And there was another fellow, but I don't think he got sick. And if Carl was still there, I don't know whether he did. But anyway, that alerted us quite quick that we had to solve that. Not only did melting it, but when you poured the mold, this fumes were always coming off. So where we poured the mold, we had a big hood over that, and we're exhausting that air too. So it sucked all that contaminated air out, blew it in the atmosphere.
Right downtown, huh?
Well,
pretty much.
Again, it was so diluted, see.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the people that you worked with. You made a list over there. We were talking before we began about Robert Lang, L-A-N-G.
Lang.
Tell me about him.
He was the founder superintendent.
I think he began about 1929, if I'm not mistaken.
That's probably right.
So he was there a long time when you started, huh?
Yeah, he worked as a molder, though.
A molder. Okay.
Yeah, he worked as an inventor. Because that was the good thing about Lufkin. They always promoted within. Always brought me within. I'm saying this right now, because that's not the company now. They bring in outsiders. When I worked for Lufkin Industries, it was a family country. You heard of it. Johnson Company, LCR, CS Johnson Company, they called it a family. Well, Lufkin was a family country because we were kind of treated like a family. In other words, the Trouts always looked after their employees. They tell me during the Depression that they ran the foundry at least one day a week so that the employees would have some money, because it got rough back then. I don't remember that, but they tell me that. So anyway, they always took care of us. Well, the attitude changed after they started going out and getting these outside directors, because the whole time I was there...
Was that a result of the company going public when it became a publicly traded company?
Well, it had part of it to do that. But see, before then, all the directors were the original descendants.
Original family, so that started.
The original descendants, yeah.
The Kurths and the Trouts.
The lawyers over in Shreveport.
The Hendersons.
Yeah, and the Hendersons, and there's a lawyer over in Shreveport. Well, I don't know who could... I know who instigated this business by bringing in some outside blood. And I won't say who it is, but I think I know who it was, because I don't want to... But anyway, they brought in some outside directors, and the place has changed over a period of time. It's not the same company. The example of that, we had a group that we called the Retired Employees of Lufkin. I don't mean exactly what we called it, but anyway. Every Wednesday of every month, the first Wednesday every month, we'd meet, we're just as a group, and tell stories, and somebody from Lufkin would usually come and bring us up to date what's going on. And he started out with an organization of about 60, well, there were about 60 employees when I was going in this organization that would meet every Wednesday. And then Luckett would have a fresh fry every May, and all of the employees were invited, all the employees, plus the retirees. So we always look forward to that. Well, after this new group came in on the board of directors from the outsiders, the attitude of the employees changed. We didn't have any new, we had few of the new employees would come meet with us, but the rule, none of them did. In other words, there have been lots of retirees since then. Well, that club just went down, down, down. Even Bob Poland, you know who Bob Poland, I used to take, he was arrested over here.
Okay, you're right.
And I used to take him to the meetings. And finally, the last time we went, he just couldn't hardly make it, and he fell, and I grabbed him, and it was right outside the door of the Lufkin barbecue, and he fell, and I fell back like that, banged my head. It knocked me out for a minute, but finally I recovered, and he didn't go back anymore. Well, I went a few more times. The club had just disbanded.
Okay.
Because we don't have that spirit anymore,
that
we used to have.
Right.
So that gets off my chest.
So Mr. Lang.
But Robert Lang was the founding superintendent, and
he your boss?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and then up and again, I don't know exactly your time. I think in the 70s, T.J. Schuler.
Yeah, but Mr. Lang retired in the 70s.
No, he died.
He died. Okay. He was still working when he died?
Yes, he was still working. He did wake up one morning. And it shocked us all. It shocked everybody. He was a smoker, and I'm not a smoker. I never did smoke. I'm a health nut. And I'd always kid him about this. Oh, I went to the doctor. He said, I'm fine. I'm fine. Well, anyway, that's another long story.
Who took his place?
Well, I was thinking that I was, but it wasn't. It was Rod Pittman. I hate mentioning Rod Pittman because he's dead too. He was younger than I was. He was a lot younger than I was. But let me get up to him.
Okay, okay.
He came in sometime in the late 50s. And he came to work with me and Arnold back there, I think. And then Arnold left, and then I was in charge back there. But I didn't exercise any authority because Rod he was an engineer, but he had an engineering technology degree. He had a lot, because he did a lot of good work. Well, anyway, after Lang died, well, they had to make an appointment. So they appointed him as assigned superintendent. And he was, I can understand why. I was not a go-getter, but he was involved in a lot of things. In other words, he was a member of the Rotary and things like that. And I wasn't.
He was more outgoing
active in things outside of
Lufkin.
So that's why he was appointed. And it disappointed me, of course. But then, after a few years, I realized that I wouldn't be good at that anyhow, because I was, as an engineer, and I like to design things, because I designed so much in that foundry. In fact, as he designed a machine, that's still being used. We had a problem with a core box we were making molds in two pieces and putting them together like that. Well, he and I came up with the idea of turning that over and making the core box and put it together like this. But then you had to separate it. Well, he designed a machine to do that, and it's still operating, because I was checking with somebody the other day, and it's still operating. So anyway, he got that job, and I guess he had it till I retired. Whenever I retired, he still had it. And, of course, after he got it, somebody else got it. I don't, because he was promoted to sales. Yeah, that's right. They thought he'd make the good. He was, I think, he was produce sales manager. And
what about Ernest Lord?
Okay, now that's another good story I want to mention. Came to the foundry in '55.
He did, or you did? I know you did, but.
No, Ernest, I don't know what, he came there right after the war.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because the reason I want to mention him was that Sam Kerr, who was an older father, he was Kerr, the famous, well, not the Kerr, but anyway, the local Kerr family.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, Sam Kerr was running the pattern shop, and Ernest came as a pattern maker. But what sticks in my mind, he was just out of the Navy. This was before I came there now, but it just came out of the Navy, and Mr. Kerr told him to build a stairway up over the office to store stuff. So that stairway was built, and it was just like in the Navy. In other words, it was just like
real small.
It didn't take up any room, you know, in the bottom. It was just really like Burt Regal, but it was a stairway.
Like on a ship or something. That, huh?
So that's what my memory of it, him. And then he, let's see here, he finally got to be, Sam Kerr retired, and he got to be pattern shop superintendent. And then later, he was assistant foundry manager. We had a fellow in there whose name was Seymour Curtis. And Seymour started at the same price, I gotta have a drink of water.
Okay, I'll pause it for just a moment then. Okay, we're back. We had to take a little break.
And we were talking about Ernest Lars. He was the founder, got to be founder superintendent. I think that's after I left again, no. And I guess after Rod went over to sales. I don't know when that was, but he went over to the sales department. And I mentioned Carl. Franklin Weeks, did I mention him?
Oh, yeah, talk about Mr. Weeks. I knew Mr. Weeks.
Okay.
Talk about him.
Franklin Weeks was in the office right next to Robert Lang, and his job was to schedule. He would take the order from the castings that, all right, that the order from the casting
here
would, I guess, came from the machine shop. I don't remember where exactly. I don't remember all the details. But anyway, you'd have orders for the casting. It was his job to schedule them so that they would come out at the right time, and you had to, not when you had to schedule a casting, you had to have to schedule the mold, the cores and everything. So that was quite a job to get all that thing. And he had a big board up there that he, I don't know how it all worked, but he had these fellas would come in and look and see what their next project was. And the fella in the main bay, we had to have a superintendent there. And the last one I remember was Kraft Finley. He was the superintendent in the main bay. And, or their foreman, not the superintendent, he was the foreman. And I cannot, it'll come to me in a minute, he's from a dive ball. The fella, we had to have somebody run the core room. And I can't remember his name. He lived at Dieball. And then we make all these castings and we have to clean them. When you shake them out, we shook them out of the mold, and we have to clean them. Well, back then, the way they cleaned them with us was a shot blast. It's the same thing as a sandblast, except it's a shot that uses steel shot. A real small, smaller than a BB. And you have this big room.
What's that word you're saying?
Shot, S-H-O-T.
S-H-O-T, okay.
Yeah, blast. You had this big room, and you would load these castings on a car and push this car in there with a forklift, as I remember, and close the door. And here comes this poor soul that goes in there with a hood on. He got a hood on. And he's got an air hose that comes at the back, so he's always got air in his hood in big exhaust. Okay. And he's taking this hose and blasting this casting with this hose to clean it.
And he's breathing oxygen
through his hood. Not oxygen, it's just air.
Just
compressed air.
Oh, okay. Not necessarily.
But unfortunately, I don't think he ever... Well, this air came from the air compressor. And we didn't have a filter on there, as I remember. I don't know. This was, again, before my time. Because, when you compress the air, you got some oil that's misted in there because the compressor. This compressors were the piston type.
Yeah, piston compressor. Yeah.
Now then, the compressors I think are all centrifugal. Right. Where you're not
mixing. So it's an oil to piston.
Yeah.
Oil.
Yeah.
Piston.
And so there was bound to be some mist in there. Well, this fellow beside that was, I don't know, he was hired that way. I think he was deaf. They called him Dummy.
Hmm.
And he could talk to you, but you'd have trouble understanding because I didn't have much to do, you know, didn't talk to him much because that wasn't my project. I mean, it wasn't my, at that time, I wasn't involved in that. But we should have had a filter on there back then, but as far as I know, he never was sick or anything. He should have been, but I guess not. Because he retired, as far as I remember.
You don't remember his name?
That's too far back again.
You don't remember his name?
That was the environment you're talking about.
Right, the working conditions. Yeah.
After they sandblast these things, they go out in the cleaning room, and these guys take chipping hammers and grinders, and they smooth all these rough spots are, in other words, where the two parts came together. You had a joint there that you might have a fin there you had to clean off. And you had to clean that off, and... that was what the cleaning room, and these guys were, it was a real noisy because they would use chipping hammers to blast this off with, and depend on how bad the mold was, in other words, because you could have a lot of defects, and sometimes these defects were such that you had to scrap the casting. You couldn't use the casting. And I cannot remember who the man was in the daytime. I should have. But we had another black fellow that was, this department ran two shifts. Well, as far as that's concerned, the main bay founder ran two shifts, but the core room only ran the one shift back then. But the clean room, they were always behind. They couldn't keep up. They were always behind on castings. And,
was the foundry unionized?
Yes. I don't know when the union came in. I think
talk a little bit about that. Were you ever in the union, or were you management, or?
Pardon?
Were you ever in the union?
No, I was strictly management. Yeah.
Okay. You had all management. Okay.
Yeah.
Talk about were there any strikes?
We had one strike when I was there for 3 months.
3 months.
No, I think we had two.
Okay.
But the. The main thing was the 3 month strike in the summertime, because I know I had my nephew wanting a job, so he came and worked during the strike as the maintenance department. But anyway, during the strike, the management ran the company. In other words, we brought over engineers and people from sales over into the foundry. And we all had jobs. Now, Rod Pittman ran a crane. He ran a crane that handled the molds, and I don't remember what all the other jobs were.
Who did the cleaning out the furnace and stuff? Who did some of that kind of work?
All right, just a minute.
I mean, maybe not the person's name, but what, I mean, if that person was on strike, who would do some of those dirty, more physical jobs?
I'll have to think back a minute, because we didn't, ordinarily, the foundry ran 5 days a week, but during the strike we didn't. I think we only poured one day a week, in other words, because with the people we had, we couldn't make enough molds, in other words. And so, how in the world did, I guess somebody, Johnny Kahn was a metallurgist, but I know he didn't do it. they must have had somebody come in. In other words, that, see.
Somebody from outside?
Well, no, one of the workers probably. In other words, some of them, you know, crossed the picket line.
Okay. We're talking about whoever, you were talking earlier about John Elijah, the black man that did all that cleaning and stuff. But like that, those kind of jobs.
Well, in the cleaning room, us management had to do that too.
Okay.
In other words, that's why we had all these folks come over from the other side. In other words, these folks in engineering, we had a lot of them over there, and a lot of them goofed off, but
So how did that affect production?
Well, of course, it knocked the heck out of it. I guess we knocked. I mean, we used inventory, I guess. In other words, and I don't remember how big it was back then.
So for 3 months, I guess you weren't able to fulfill orders and things and commitments,
but,
right?
See, the oil business back then go up and down, up and down, and because. Just like in 1980, whenever I retired, there was a little period there. And they were laying off a lot of people. Well, in my case, they said, you can either keep working, and in other words, or if you retire, I retired at 60, and said, if you retire, we'll pay you till you get 62. In other words, the difference between your what your Social Security would be, I believe. I don't remember exactly. But anyway, I got to stop in for my retirement, I guess, to make up for Social Security. Because then after I started drawing Social Security, I don't know how that worked. But anyway, I got an extra amount till I reached 62. And then I retired. I mean, I was already retired. I retired at 50, but I didn't draw Social Security until I was 62.
You mean you retired at 60?
Yes.
60. Okay.
Yeah. And but didn't get my retirement to my Social Security. But they said, we want you to stay. They want me to stay. And said, you've got 2 weeks or something to make up your mind. And when the period came to tell them, I was still, but I said, I'll retire. In other words, and I don't regret it.
Because you said you retired in 86. Officially, right? Yeah. So you would have been 62 in 86. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
So, is there anything else you can share about the working with the unions?
Well, I didn't have anything to do with the unions. That was strictly that was one of the reasons glad I didn't take that job. In other words, the superintendent.
Oh, he was the Rob Pittman guy. Okay. Yeah. So you didn't have to.
Yeah, I didn't have to do with that.
You didn't have to do with that. Okay.
I haven't mentioned Seymour Curtis. And Seymour was another long-time employee, and he would end up as assistant founder superintendent, as I recall, I was right under Robert Lang. And then I think that he stayed there after Rod took over a job. I don't remember because well, I probably.
Go ahead.
Seymour didn't have a very good reputation with the blacks. He always kind of you don't have to mention. He was old. He was of the old school. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
And before I came there, this was a sideline that they stood. Well, for a while, when business would slack off. Arnold Tompkins, this was way back there in the early years. Arnold Tompkins would, when I was supposed to go out and hustle business, in other words. And I went out, I don't know how many times with him, because he was the senior employee back then, he knew more than I did. But anyway, we got a job from somewhere, I don't remember who it was, and I had to do the calculations to figure the cost. And somewhere I made an error in there, and the company lost a little money, but it wasn't a huge amount. In other words, because this was kind of a sideline. But anyway, I didn't lose my job over it. I don't remember that Ed Trout ever even said anything to me, because back then we were working for Ed Trout. In other words,
And what was his position?
Ed Trout.
Ed Trout at that time?
He was a vice president.
Vice president, okay.
Right under his brother, who was the president. W.W. Trout.
Okay.
Was the president at that time. And
so you reported to, I forgot now who you said. In the early days, Lang was your boss, and then Lang reported to Ed Trout?
Yeah, that's right. That's
okay.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay.
Ed Trout used to quote the founder in his Cadillac and park just outside the foundry office and blow his horn, and that used to upset Robert Lang for him to blow his horn on him to come out there for curb service.
Curb service.
he would come in, but then when he'd come in, he would prop his feet up on his desk and all that.
So when he wanted to see him, he just honked his horn, huh?
Yeah. And I want to mention Bobo Hayes.
Okay.
One of the aluminum products that we produced was for a little bet casting for the pumping unit. And it was a little thing that was made out of aluminum. It looked like a top hat, but it was only about 2 inches tall. And we made that in the aluminum foundry. And Bobo Hayes was one of the foremen over in the machine shop. But he would take those home and machine them himself. There was a little sideline for him, but he machined those things on his own, in his little shop. And he used to always call me and says, "You got any castings for me?" And I'd say, "Yeah." Same way with, you don't know the fellow that made the bottoms, his name was...
The what?
Just a minute, it's coming to me. This fellow, he didn't work in our department. He worked over in a machine shop. And he made all the models for the pumping units and things to take to the trade shows.
The models, okay. Yeah. How big were these models?
Usually about like that.
He's saying about like a foot?
Yeah.
Foot and a half or something?
Yeah. It was just a pumping unit, in other words, like
right.
This.
But it was to scale, huh?
Yeah, it was to scale. Yeah, very good, yeah.
Was it operable? Did it operate?
Yeah, it had
did
a motor.
It was functioning?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it like battery powered or?
No, it plugged in.
Just plugging in electric, okay.
Well, I wanted to mention him. I'm going to mention Bob Bedingfield. You ever heard of Bob Bedingfield? Well, Bob Bedingfield was a electrician, but he was real good. He was a real nice fella, a church going fella. His wife is still living down the street, or I don't know how she makes it. He died many, many years ago.
What are some of the other products you made? You made castings for the oil field, the pumping units, gearboxes, I guess.
Yeah, and well, I'm gonna, before I came there, all I heard about were the Matheson rings.
The what?
The Matheson.
Matheson?
Yeah, that's a chemical company somewhere. I don't know whether it's Houston or Beaumont or where, but it's a chemical company, and they made some huge castings for them. And they used to always talk about the Matheson. As I said, that before I came there.
Yeah.
And I didn't know about
rings.
Rings, yeah.
R-I-N-G-S.
R-I-N-G-S. And I assume that they. I don't know how they use them. I just know that they talked about the Matheson rings. So. They were proud.
They were real proud of them. Huh? And what was that used for? The Matheson rings?
It was a chemical plant.
Chemical plant.
Yeah,
okay.
So don't tell where it was used.
Okay. Did y'all ever make stuff for the trailer plant?
Yes, in a way we were. I mentioned it.
Okay.
I forgot to mention that. And there's a little aluminum foundry. You've already talked to Jim, so you know about the trailer. Well, up in the corner, up at the top on the front of the trailer, there's a curved casting. There was. And we used to have to make those for them. In other words, forgot what to call those things, but anyway, we cast those in aluminum for them.
At the top of a van?
Yeah, at the top of a van.
On the outside?
On the outside, yeah.
Huh.
It waterproofed that corner. See,
okay.
See the curve, the front of the trailer was flat and curved around like this. And,
okay.
And but it did curve at the top, so anywhere this cast.
So just hid the seam where the top and the sides
came together.
Kinda.
And I presume that they caulk it or something.
And that was aluminum?
That was aluminum.
Aluminum, okay. Yeah, I've seen that. I know what you're talking about. I don't know what it's called. Yeah. But
well, we made those for years.
You made those, okay.
I don't know whether...
Talk about the... I've seen some photographs, maybe it was before your time, but of the engineering department. It was just a big room with a bunch of drafting tables. Was that where you worked? Or
no, I had my own engineering department.
You had your own engineering department. Yeah.
That engineering department, I won't say we were a step shop, but we had our own little regime over there.
Your own regime.
Yeah. It was the founder department. So that's why I was the chief engineer. Because Bill Hopper was over there at the other. And he had all these other, he had many, many engineers where I only had usually Rod Pittman or I trained quite a few that came through there. In other words, when Bay or somebody would hire a new engineer over there, they would send them around to all the departments for maybe a month or so.
Orientation, like?
For orientation, that's right. And so I got to meet a lot of them that way. But
how many did you have working for you?
Well, I guess, is it one, two, three, about I hadn't mentioned Scott Semlinger. He worked for me.
Scott who?
Semlinger.
Semlinger.
You haven't heard of Scott? Well, that's that's funny that I was. Well, I'm 90 years old. I can't remember everything. But anyway, Scott was in my department. He was the top of the line. He was real smart, and I used him a lot. And then I had Bill Fincher that came over from the trailer plant. And I had one other engineer who I can't remember his name.
Did you hire any Longhorn engineers, or were they Aggies?
No. I beg your pardon, I did too.
You did, okay.
We hired, I can't remember his name, but he was. And he didn't work too long because, one thing, was that the one that split up with his wife? He had one that... His wife kicked him out. He was living over in a motel. And then, I don't know whether it was him, and then another one, his wife couldn't stand the pine pollen here. He had to quit.
Hmm.
And
so where did some of the people come from that you hired? I mean, what part, what was their background?
Well, mainly it was... Of course, Scott came from A&M with a biomedical degree. And of course, that meant, like a lot of kids back there, he didn't know what he wanted to take, so he took that. But he was a good engineer because, see, by the time he came over, computers were coming in. And I'm the old fashioned type. We did all our calculations with a slide rule. So you can't do that anymore. It's got to be exact. We did all our calculation. We didn't know what computer. We made all our drawings with a pencil. In fact, as I wrote up the last, I would pencil and make a sketch of what I wanted and give it to a draftsman, and he would do it. And he was already taking computer design. He could do it with a computer, and I didn't. But that all came in just as I was leaving. In fact, it's all the computers the same way.
Right when you were leaving, huh?
In the foundry, we used to have a time card, and when a guy would punch in, he'd punch in at the middle of the day. I mean, he had to punch a time card for his paycheck, and then he would punch a time card for his different jobs, and that's how it kind of kept cost of the time on the different jobs.
Like the different departments and things, charged to different departments.
And then they converted part of that to IBM system of punch cards. You ever see an IBM?
Yeah. Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah, we had those, and then it finally got to their computers, and that's about the time I left.
My father was a computer analyst, programmer analyst. So when I was a kid, we used to play with the old computer punch cards, you know, and sometimes we'd go up to my dad's office and we'd type out our name, he'd punch out the letters.
All right, now where'd you go to school?
I went to Lufkin High School, graduated in 85.
What?
My dad worked for Temple in the computer.
In other words, you haven't been to college yet?
Oh, no, I did, yeah, Stephen F. Austin.
Okay, kind of guessed that, but...
Yeah. But
your dad worked for Temple?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You just saying the word Temple made me think of Bill Temple. What did you know Bill Temple?
Oh yeah, very well.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did he do?
Bill Temple was
did you work with him much or
no, but I used to eat lunch with him. His wife was a teacher. And I had a Model B Ford. Model B Ford. That was the first V8 that they came out with. And that's another long story that my younger brother bought it and went to Canada in it and came back. And I bought it from them. And he had another guy went to Canada and came back. And
The flathead V8?
Flathead V8 was the first. In fact, as I put the motor... Took the motor out and put another motor in it myself. In other words, I got a 1% robot. And so Bill Temple's wife was a teacher. So I used to pick him up every day at lunch and we would go to Perry's Cafeteria.
Okay.
You ever heard of Perry's Cafeteria?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We'd eat lunch and so. And what in the world did he do though?
Well, that's okay. I just have to think
somebody
of that.
Have to tell you that because I don't remember that, but...
Yeah. But you used to have lunch with him, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But I knew him real well because, real sad story, did you know him?
A little bit, yes, sir.
Well, what happened was that he got some sort of a infection, and it was serious, and they had to cut off... that word, it spread real fast, and I can't remember what they call it, but you really got to be careful. If you don't feel right, you need to make sure that you, because this stuff spread fast. Then they had to cut off part of his fingers and cut off both of his ankles. And I don't remember whether he ever had, what do you call them? You know, but anyway, he was real tragic. I had to go through, but he was always upbeat. The guy, he always had a joke. He was a real fine fella. Oh, I always had a joke. Of course, he was a Temple, in other words.
Yes.
He was from Texarkana. That's where the Temples came from or something.
So, you mentioned the computers, that they were just coming in as you were leaving. Any other ways that changes in technology affected the way Lufkin Industries operated during your time?
I guess that because that's just about, as I said, about the time, except for the new processes. And then, well, you're going to be exposed to this, so I'll tell you this story. You know that GE is fixing to, maybe you don't know, GE is fixing to expand the foundry.
Just what I read in the paper.
Okay. And they're going to tear down part of the east end of it and build part of the new one and then come down and tear the rest of it. Well, they're doing away with this cupola. We got a cupola there now. It needs to be replaced, as I told you.
Dates back to when you were there, huh?
That was just as I was leaving. But in that case, we contracted with a manufacturer to redo the whole thing. The way we loaded the coke and all of that. In other words, it was all automated because most of that was done by, you know, batch at a time. But now it was automated back then. And then we put in this cupola and we put in a baghouse system that I didn't approve of. In other words, I was overruled. It says, no, this is cheaper than this. So we're going to put this one in. Well, we had no end of hell with it. In other words, trying to maintain it. So I went back and said, let's put in this new system that I proposed already. So they did that, and it's still operating. And I can't remember the name of the guy. This old guy was from California. He was an old fella, an old school. And but he was experienced in this type of work, and we got a huge bag house that's nearly as big as this room. You know what a bag house is?
No, is it like BHG?
A bag house is where you take the dirty gas.
Spell it.
What? BAG.
Okay, BAG bag house. Okay.
You take the dirty gas and you suck it into this big box, and it has bags hanging down. And you can either do it two ways. You can blow the air in, I mean, bring that dirty bag in this way in the bag. In that case, they're upside down. Or you can bring the dirty air on the outside of the bag, and the dust collects on the bag, and you suck it at the top. So the dust is just like a vacuum cleaner, only a big, big, much bigger. So anyway, this fella, the bags has to be the right composition because of the composition of the gases, and he had all that worked out. So anyway, that was an expensive system, and it was that was one of the big projects that I had. The best thing that, put it this way, the smartest thing that I ever did that I worked for Lufkin, I say the smartest, when you have a centrifugal fan, is like on your room air conditioner. You know, it looks like a squirrel cage, and it spins, and it blows the air on the, you know, from the outside, sucks it on the inside. All right. In certain cases, you want to control the amount of air that you're sucking. In other words, you don't want to suck too much air, you're not sucking enough. So the way you would do that, you'd put a baffle in front of that intake and cut it down. And you're still using the same amount of horsepower to spin that thing and suck it, because we're sucking the lower air. but that was very inefficient. Well, in the meantime, they came up with these diodes. And a diode changes the frequency. And don't ask me how, I'm not an electrical engineer. But we bought this thing, and I don't know how much it cost us. I don't remember. It wasn't that expensive. Because we had this 500 horsepower motor again. It was sucking on this bag house that's back here. And this thing this motor was turning at 3,600 RPM. Well, we didn't need it to turn that fast. This dial, you could dial, and this is real common now, you could just dial what you wanted, and it would slow that thing down. It would slow down whatever you wanted. You could get that thing to where it just barely turned, or just as fast as you wanted to, but just turn that dial. Because, and that's used everywhere now, in other words. Mm-hmm. But I bought the first one, in other words, and I said, that's about the smartest thing I ever did, because all this time we were choking these blowers off with this baffle, and now then you just control the amount of horsepower that you put in there. So
you didn't have to have all the baffles and things.
Yeah, didn't have to have the baffle, no.
Was your office, were their offices air conditioned when you started? Or did they become air conditioned at some point, or do you remember?
It must not have been, because I wouldn't remember where the air conditioning was. Because they were heated.
You had heat, but not AC, huh?
Well, that's funny that I can't remember that. Now, they weren't, because it was a central system.
But it was air conditioned when you left, though, right?
Oh, yeah, we built a new office.
Built a new office, okay.
Yeah, because where the old offices were, there's another foundry there now. That's another long story.
Okay.
We've seen.
Was that in the early 80s?
Yeah, during the 80s, we did this big expansion. I think it was, I don't remember how many million dollars it was. In other words, it was during one of the surges in the oil production. And so we wanted to produce all these castings. So we had this firm out of Chicago come in and design this new foundry. In other words, this huge building and big pits and all that, wham, the vodka dropped right out of market. We dropped the whole thing.
What did you drop?
Well, the project, I meant.
Oh, the project.
We just dropped the project. In other words, that you'll use what you got.
It was too much.
But that was a big disappointment because we were going to really be in high cutting. We had this thing all mechanized. Well,
who was the CEO then? Was Mr. Poland the CEO at that time?
I believe he was. Okay. Now you mentioned, yes, yeah, he was. There he was.
So they weren't ready to spend that much money, huh?
Well, no, not if it didn't have a return on it. You got to have a return.
Yeah.
You can't. They quit the project because the bottom dropped out of the oil market.
Okay.
That's why they decided. What are we going to do with all those castings if you can't sell them? So they were a smart deal. Now, they, as I said, they're since utilizing all that building, though. So there have been lots of changes since I've been there.
What,
getting around to the expansion that GE is doing, there's a substation there on the corner of whatever that street is. In other words, right across from the Strucco shop. You probably know it. It's Regay and Pershing. Okay. It's a big substation there. Well, we had to put that in. I don't think I discussed this, but there was a problem. There was a point where we couldn't get any coke. Did I tell you about that? I told you about the shortage of natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then there's going to be a shortage of coke. So we said, well, we're going to have to put in electric belching because we can't get any coke to run the cupola. Well, we spent several million dollars putting in this electric furnace, and for the life of me, I can't remember whether it was one or two. But anyway, you put this electric furnace in, but there was nowhere near enough power. Before that, all the power for Lufkin came from a substation out there north of Lufkin. It all came there. And there was no way we could get that much power. So, went to TP&L, I can't remember that guy's name, and so they agreed to put the substation in out here. And we got the big transformer is for the rest of the old rest of the plant, but the smaller transformer was for the electric furnace. And we operated that electric furnace for several years. And I don't remember why we finally shut it down. I guess because it got to be too expensive. I don't remember. But anyway.
How did it compare to the other furnace, the coke furnace?
Well,
was it as good or worse?
Yeah, it was probably better because you just only melted iron. And if you choose your scrap carefully, you didn't have much slag like you do with a cupola. You got all kinds of slag to contend with.
And
we had slag, but it was not anywhere near like it was.
And what did y'all do with the slag again?
Gave it away. There are many a country lane, you know, people would come get it for put it in a yard, not in a yard, but in the driveway.
Driveways and
stuff. But it wasn't very good for that because it would...
It's too light, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of lightweight, isn't it?
Yeah, it would crush and I think that's... I can't remember exactly. I can remember seeing him haul it off, but I can't remember...
Where it went?
Yeah,
okay.
It was too far.
Talk a little bit more about what it was like working for a company like Lufkin Industries when you were there.
Well, I already mentioned the fact that it was a family-owned company. Mm-hmm. In other words, they believed in taking care of their employees. They offered me stock after about 2 years. The fact is, I think I bought stock from Ed Trout. As I recall, I bought... Maybe with 2 shares or 10 shares, in other words. I went to the bank. By the way, I'm single, if you didn't know that. I'm single, never married, so I don't have too much expense. But anyway, I went to the bank to borrow the money for this stock because I forgot how much I borrowed. But I went to the bank and I said, I need to borrow the money. I want to buy some Lufkin stock. And she said, well, what security do you have? I said, well, I got the stock. He says, oh, no, you got to have more than that. I'll never forget that old gal. But I had already started. I've been investing in stock from the second job that I worked at. In other words, I went to the dividend investment plan, and I just accumulated some. And now then I just live off my dividends. So. But anyway, that's where I thought it was unusual that she said, oh, you got to have more than that. That stock's quite good enough. So I had enough there somehow. That was the only loan that I ever made. I've never borrowed any money since then, except, of course, I owned a house before I came over here. I've had cars and motorhomes and things like that.
Did you ever visit any of the other foundries that Lufkin Industries had outside of Lufkin?
We did that all the time because to get out ears. In other words, I'm going to have to knock this off after a while.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
No, not right now, but the dog wants to go walking. Every 2 years we'd have a foundry conference, and that's when all the founders in the United States would get together, and we were run by the American Foundry Society, and we'd have a convention, and it'd be in different large cities. Never was in Lufkin because we weren't big enough, but Atlantic City, the first one I went to was Atlantic City. They don't have it there anymore because it's not. But in Chicago and Cleveland and anywhere where there's a lot of foundries, Pittsburgh. But anyway, you would go to these conventions and pick up new ideas, and you'd run up a nice expense account. They never question you. In other words, Lufkin never questioned you. That's what I'm talking about. It's a family country. They knew you padded that expense account a little bit. But anyway, you'd visit these. Always there was a foundry visit involved in all of these conventions that you visit foundries. So I visited foundries all over the country. In fact, I've been overseas a few times. Yeah. I'm trying to remember.
What about some of the other Lufkin Industry foundries?
We don't have any more. There weren't any more foundries. Okay. Well, they are now, but not
yeah, one. I forget where it was, but there was one in Arkansas during your time.
That's right.
That y'all bought or something.
Yeah, that's right. We bought that, whatever Rod Pittman's doing. I didn't approve of that either because...
That was just outside Little Rock, I believe.
Yeah, it was... I can't call the name, but they bought that foundry because they thought they'd get a lot of production out of it. And they did, but it was run by a real nice guy, but he wasn't a founderman. They made castings. There was no question about that. They had a different type of melting. They had what's called an induction furnace, where you have this crucible and you... Induce a current around it that forms like a transformer. In other words, this cycling coil around there heats the metal, and that's how it was done. That's what's called an induction furnace.
Because
we had, I think we put one in left before I left.
Okay.
Anyway, I'd had to go over there several times and put some equipment in. In other words, they upgraded it, and finally, I forgot what happened to it. This fellow that was running it over there, I'd never forget his name. Coulter, something Coulter, Bob Bill. Anyway, after the founder closed, he came to Lufkin and went to sales, and he got laid off. That was after I was retired. And the poor guy, he was in his 50s, or I think he was 55. And, you can record this, but it's all right. He was in his 50s and couldn't find a job. So finally, he was a big Arkansas man. Yeah, he got...
A Razorback, University of Arkansas?
Yeah, Razorback.
Okay.
And... He had a buddy over there that was in some sort of business, so he gave him he said, here, you go into screw business. And this guy, had him going around and selling screws for the people that make the aluminum windows. In other words, and the poor guy took the company car that he had. He paid for it somehow because he didn't have a car. And he didn't have the insurance on it. Well, anyway, since I wasn't doing anything, I had a BMW at that time, and then he would drive it, and I would go with him, and we'd make the all these calls. Just an overnight, during the daytime only. And I'd make all these calls with him, and finally the guy died of a brain, something in his brain, tumor or something. But he was a real fine fella, except that he, after you get 50, in other words, it's hard to find a job.
Well, Mr. Jersey, that's pretty much all that I had, unless you had anything else to add in closing about your experiences with Luffy Industries.
I haven't covered it all, but I'm tired.
Okay, well, and I know Jesse here wants to take a walk.
Yes.
Well, again, I thank you very much.
Okay. And if you got questions or things you don't understand,
we'll get back in touch with you.
I think I've mentioned everybody.
Okay, I'll go ahead and stop it. Thank you.
All right.